All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What the fucking ears? What's happening? What the fucking avians? Yeah. How's that? Because I'm in Scandinavia. It's kind of a riff on Scandinavians. Did you get that? Did you dig it? I did that for all the people that will, you know, hopefully have come to my show last night. I've traveled to Oslo, Norway, which is where I'm at now, in a hotel room that is overlooking the National Theater, which is quite a building. It has been a fun and exciting trip here to the birthplace of Minnesota, and it gives me a whole new insight into the upper Midwest of America. But Norwegians and Swedes in their environment, very pleasant people. It's beautiful up here, though. Honestly, and don't tell Sweden this, but I'm enjoying Oslo a little more. Maybe I've just locked into the groove. Maybe I've relaxed into it a little bit. Or maybe it's just there's something different about this city. I like both of them, but Oslo is very beautiful. I went to a castle. It was around a long time ago, and then they made some renovations. It has been used on and off over the years. There's several different types of rocks involved from different eras that things were built on. It's up on a hill. There's bricks and wooden doors. There's archways. There's holes for cannons. And it overlooks a fjord, I believe it would be. I believe that I'm now just half a two blocks away from a fjord, which I don't think I have been before. And went to a lovely museum here. Great contemporary art collections in both Sweden and here. I would tell you the name of that gallery if I could. Oh, here. I have the museum guide right here. It's the Astrup Fearnley Museet. I don't know. I don't know how to pronounce it. Let's just say museum. And I saw some great stuff there. I did. I really did. And Sarah even liked most of it. It was exciting to go see contemporary art where it's very personal for her because these are people she knows. She's got her tastes. And I need to be educated sometimes. I don't quite know why things I like are important or not important. But I learn. Which is a nice way to say, I take it, folks. I take it. Oh, boy. Having a good time out here on the road. Good times. So we went to the Viking Museum, and I saw a Viking ship. And there was a bunch of Viking artifacts around. And I don't know. I feel very connected to it. I'm not sure what I'm experiencing here in Norway. But I feel very connected, and I highly doubt that I have any unknown Viking ancestry. Though it's possible, it looks like they got around. Looks like they, at some point they might have even dipped into Poland. It looks like they parked a ship, if I was looking at the routing correctly. They made it all over the place. Ireland, I believe Dublin, if I'm not mistaken, from the two sentences I read earlier that I'm assuming are true, might have even been founded by Vikings. There seemed to be some Gaelic Viking crossover, but they got around, man. They got all the way down around to the top of Africa. They got around into the Mediterranean Sea, and then they kind of moved up. They noodled up into Europe, and it looks like they might have touched ground just outside of Poland and hiked down into Poland, perhaps doing some conquering, some pillaging, maybe a little raping. So I'm not saying that I have any Viking in me. What I am positing here is that it's possible, and perhaps I should get my genetics done, because I would like to know if I have any Viking in me, because the pull is pretty strong up here. But I'd like to believe that I am one of a select few Viking Jews. You know, the Viking Jews, the Jews that, you know, got a little queasy on the boats, weren't great with swords. But see that, see what I'm stereotyping. I just caught myself in, I was stereotyping Viking Jews. There were some tremendous Viking Jews, very powerful conquerors. Goldberg the Almighty was as everybody knows, one of the most powerful Viking Jews. There was Stein the Frightening, if people remember. There was Iskowitz, the terror of Poland for a minute. you do look at the swords and the engravings and stuff, and you find how it's very compelling, and you can see where the metal guys like it, where the leather guys like it, where, you know, belts, people who make belts and leather things enjoy Viking stuff. People with, you know, hardy beards. I mean, I get it. I get it. People who enjoy wearing helmets with horns on them, which are back. I don't know where you live, but there's a, I think there's some of that going on in Brooklyn, maybe out in Highland Park where I used to live. You're seeing the horns on helmets again. The helmets that come all the way down with the steel nose guard are happening. It was only a matter of time. You know, once the beards came out, it was only a matter of time before the horned helmets would make their way back into coffee shops. Did I mention that Bradley Whitford is on the show today for no real reason? It's always nice to talk to Bradley. I've met him a couple times. He's one of those guys that I'm like, I know I'm going to get along with this guy, but he was, you know, he was a nice chap, but he wasn't really plugging anything. Just came by, wanted to hang out, talk a bit. It was really like that. So what's going on in the States? I got to say, I haven't been watching TV. I've been checking the news occasionally. It doesn't seem like anything great is happening. It does feel like something is falling apart. I just hope it's the right thing. Oh, boy. Now I'm a little giddy. I don't know if the air is thin here. It does stay light a long time. It's only about 5 or 6 hours of darkness, it feels like. Maybe, I don't know. I go to bed, it just got dark at like 9:30, 10. I wake up, you know, sometimes during the night, and it seems like it's light at 4 or 5. I could research all of this. But as some of you know, I like to speculate. I'm enjoying it here. Oh, yeah, I just realized. You know what might be doing it? What might be creating some genetic exhilaration and connectivity to this region is smoked fish. Like, that might be it. Like, I had some herring this morning and some smoked salmon and some rye, and maybe that's just triggered something. Maybe it's not genetic at all. Maybe it got all my Jew genes excited, and then I felt connected to everything because I'd been fished up in the morning. I got the smoked fish buzz of my people. All right, now I'm going to Google Jews in Norway because I don't know if I'm the only one here right now. Anyways, Bradley Whitford back in the garage. This is still some of the archive from the old garage, and you can see him on the new season of The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu, which premieres this week. And, of course, he had a great year in 2017 in the movie Get Out and the other movie, The Post. A lot of Whitford around. Good guy. He's got an edge to him, this guy. Got a little bit of an edge from the Midwest, too, as I recall. Maybe he's part Viking. I can't remember if we talked about that. Jew Vikings, watch out for us. In Brooklyn, we're the ones wearing the helmets with the horns. This is me and Bradley Whitford back in the garage. I guess I don't generally talk politics, but I guess it's Hollywood. I don't know. I don't know what this podcast is. I've had a lot of different types of people here, I'd like to think. But I did have a sitting president.
Yeah. But did that, he sit, you know, here?
He sat there.
He sat here.
Yeah, he sat right there. You've met him before, though, haven't you?
Yeah, well, okay.
Don't you West Wing alumni have special privileges within the Democratic government?
Yeah.
Any of you could just go to the White House and you're like, oh, come on, you're familiar with...
I have to tell you, it's incredible to me how, as an actor, everybody loves Hollywood.
Yeah.
They will let you in anywhere. I was doing research for one of the first movies I did, Presumed Innocent, and I was playing a lawyer, and they said, well, you can go to court.
Yeah.
And it was a superior court judge,
yeah,
in New York. And I walk in and she goes, oh, you're with the movie. Come up, sit next to me. And I'm sitting next to this judge as she's sentencing people.
Presumed Innocent, though, that was a pretty good, who directed that? Was it
Alan Pakula?
Yeah, right. And this was like, you know, he did The Parallax View, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he did
Sophie's Choice.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. All the President's Men, too.
Yeah, the President's Men.
That's such a great fucking movie.
Yeah, it is. Oh, it's unbelievable, All the President's Men.
But, okay, so working on The Post.
Yeah.
So how does that work? You get a script from Spielberg. You got to audition. What? I imagine you got cast. You didn't have to go read for it, did you?
I read the original script, and then I heard talk that they were interested in me, and then you go over to Amblin and you go through some extreme security and a delousing procedure.
Right, they look in your eyeball, iris, and they thumbprint. And
then you go into a secure room and you sign an NDA.
Before reading the script?
Yes.
Right.
No, before cuddling with Mr. Spielberg.
You're not seeing, you broke the NDA.
I'm sorry, I broke it. And so I read it, and then...
You got to go sit there at Amblin to read it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I was leaving. It was a great script, and I'm leaving, and then they said, no, he wants to talk to you, and then I go into a room, and he comes in, and like as an actor, you're like... You know, do I have it? You know, he's like, yeah. But he was funny. He was like, this character is not a real human being. This is not a human who existed. It's a kind of an amalgamation of sort of male business interests.
Yeah.
So he goes, I like it when I don't know it's you, which is either a compliment or a criticism. But he said, throw yourself off a little bit visually. I'm like, okay.
What does that mean to you in that moment?
I sort of get what he wants. I immediately go to a joke, like, you know, can I give him a seizures? You know,
right.
Is there something like...
A tick,
yeah. Yeah. You know, yeah.
Mild Tourette's. Yeah.
I actually joked with him about the opportunity. Like, I could do something incredibly crazy and specific, and everybody watching this movie would think, wow, he must be nailing it, because nobody would just play it like that.
Right.
And then he said, I want you to sound a little different.
Than you.
And I'm like, an accent? And he goes, yeah, but I don't really want to know it's an accent. I'm like, so like a half-ass accent?
Yeah. He's basically just saying, like, don't bring yourself too much to this part. Leave you at home.
I want you.
I need you to act.
Not that much.
Yeah.
And then, but the funny thing is that I go, like, it's a complicated script. You know, it moves around.
A little too much for my...
Okay.
I liked it. You were good in it.
Steven, that's what Marc Maron thinks of you.
Yeah.
So I said, are we going to rehearse? And he goes, no, I don't like to rehearse. He goes, Meryl wants to rehearse. And I'm like, maybe you should do what Meryl wants.
Yeah.
And he goes, no, I don't like to rehearse. And I think there are virtues, actually, weirdly, to not rehearsing. And I go, well, when's the read-through? And he goes, oh, I don't like read-throughs. And he goes, yeah, Meryl wants one of those. And I said, why don't you like read-throughs? And he said, because it gives everyone the impression that this process is more democratic than it really is.
Really?
Laughing.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
But that was interesting. So
no read-through, no rehearsal. You just show up for work on the day they're shooting your scenes.
Yeah, and you go quickly. It's interesting because... Like, I did a movie years ago with Eastwood, who's like the same thing. You don't even know the cameras.
Which movie?
A Perfect World.
I remember it.
Yeah.
I remember, like, because it was
Costner,
like one of,
Costner
it was Costner
was
played a heavy, and it was like a big deal. Like, he's playing a shitty guy, right?
Right, and he was great in that.
Yeah, I remember, yeah. Yeah, and but so both Eastwood and Spielberg shoot quick.
Yeah, and their virtues, their faults to it, you know.
Which are what? You get done with a take and they're moving on. You're like, but I didn't.
Yeah. Well, Clint's thing is, I asked him why he doesn't say action. And he said when he was doing Rawhide, they would struggle to get horses on marks, which is not easy to do. And then these directors would come in and go, action. and the horse would rear up, and yeah. he felt like people do too.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Well, I think so. Have you ever had directors who have like a big action pronouncement?
Well, I mean, I haven't done that much. You know, I know you're probably thinking about my entire repertoire of films and television shows, but I've not done much. But yeah, certain directors come in, they do it differently. But never, I've never been on a set with a major director where everybody's sort of waiting. You know, you're on TV set and it's sort of like, you know the guy who says it and it's all right. It's never been that jarring.
Yeah, it's not a big deal.
There was one guy that some people do it. They're dramatic about it. Action! You know, like they, yeah. some people just say action. And then
action! Other, I know somebody who does action! And it's like, why are you making this? Joel Schumacher was, everybody focused and action! It was terrifying.
You're unfocused.
Directors, Mike Nichols said this thing about directors that it's like sex. Like yeah. directors have no idea how other people do it because they're generally the only ones there performing that specific role.
Yeah, that's interesting. Unless you started as a cinematographer.
But as an actor,
yeah.
if like you're on a series, you're getting fucked by somebody new every week. Yeah, I mean, yeah. you really get to see a lot of different. You really get to see a lot of different styles.
What is the liability, though, of moving quickly, you were going to say?
Well, what's good about do you care about baseball?
Sure.
Sure. You know, when knuckleball pitchers come in, there are very few strikes thrown, and yeah. everybody in the field kind of gets lazy. Yeah. And if you know you're going to get an infinite number of takes, you tend to not like really get ready.
Yeah.
With Spielberg or with Eastwood, you know that your first take is going to be seen by your grandchildren.
Right.
So you gear up. it focuses the mind. And it's changed now, the technology. Like when West Wing started, you had to load film. There was this tangible thing that you didn't want to run out of at the end of the take.
They had those big things that had to snap onto the camera.
Yeah.
What is it called? The not cartridges or... Change the magazine.
Mag.
Yeah.
Change the mag. And with that, there's kind of a psychology of, we don't want to waste this. Now,
sure.
almost everybody is shooting digitally. And
plenty to waste.
Yeah. And there are virtues to it. I actually think it's changed acting because you can afford to just, leave it on and catch some behavior, but it also drags out the shooting process.
I think that's true. I think that, like, in the same way where, like, the shift from typewriter to word processor to computer, that, it enables you not so much to get sloppy, but perhaps to over, it maybe makes you lazy in a way, too, I think.
Yeah, if you're scrawling it with a feather, and you can't erase it, you're going to, really think about
it. White out.
If you got a hammer and a chisel on a wall, you're really going to think about it.
But that brings up that's what's good about shooting quick, is that like it focuses you and you really got to show up for work.
Yeah, yeah, and also it does something. It's a really interesting thing because actors are always trying to get comfortable in a very uncomfortable situation. And can tend to get too comfortable. Like they will actually, especially in success as an actor, be more comfortable than any human being has ever been asking to pass the salt.
Right, sure, right.
Because they're just trying to get comfortable. It's interesting to me how actors spend, like being relaxed is the most important thing as an actor, but it can sometimes lead to a kind of, passivity.
Yeah, but also, isn't there the threat too, and I only notice this with my limited experience in acting, that, if you get too comfortable, that you might just be you. Like, you just, comfort yourself right out of the character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Know? And where you don't, you do a scene, and you're like, wait, I think I was just me eating. Can we...
I forgot the character.
Yeah, right. I mean, is that possible? Or is that crazy?
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird thing because you're always, it's a whole discussion. So when did you start?
Acting?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, like, you know, I did a little in college here and there, but I did four seasons of my own show on IFC. Yes. And I knew that there was a curve. You know, I knew I could be present and I knew I could listen, but
that's all you need to do.
But there's something about movement that, you know, you're going to be awkward the first bit. You know, I knew my
you
first season.
You were awkward physically playing yourself.
Yeah, because, like, you know, you don't want to be self-conscious of what you're saying, which I'm good at not doing that, but I do get self-conscious of, like, should I just be standing here? Am I, my hands, what's going on? You know, like, yeah, that kind of shit. But then that goes away. So I haven't been doing it, you know, professionally for that long. Like, with Glow, this is only the second big thing I've done.
I like Glow.
Oh, thanks. I mean, I'm just a small part of it, but I appreciate you liking it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
But I find myself, like, this second season, I started to, like, originally I was sort of like, man, there's a lot of waiting around.
Oh, God.
Right? And you're waiting around to do, like, a five-minute thing, and like, you know, you can't get mad about it because, you know.
Because you're lucky.
Yeah, and also that's a job, but it's like, I didn't act my whole life, so a lot of times when I'm on set, I'm like, I could be doing other shit.
Okay. Listen, I find this, I say all the time, I love acting, I despise shooting. The process is, I love the community on the set.
Yeah.
But it is this weird combination of glacial and anxious. And it is, you always think, I'm going to be able to get something done. You can't get anything done.
No, you just sit there with your phone all day, you know, and then, like, I imagine whatever you shot last, you're just looking at the news constantly and trying to balance that emotional reaction with whatever you're doing.
Yeah, it's an excruciating.
Yeah, we were on set when Trump won. All those women and me were there that night.
Jesus, how was that?
It's horrible. Everyone was crying.
Right.
It was terrible. But in terms of your question asking me, like, I haven't been doing it that long. And what I've noticed, what I was getting at was that in the second season, I realized, well, you know, work when you got to work. Like, you know, really enjoy it. If you like acting, it's going to happen. Your scene's coming up.
Right.
You know, so deliver, you know, be in it as much as you can. Like, that's when the work happens. It's in television. It's, you know, it happens quickly. You got to do some coverage. But, like, you know, here comes your time. You've been sitting around for 4 hours.
Right, right. Yeah, get ready. Yeah, yeah, you got to get ready. But the process is excruciating. When I die and go to hell, yeah, it's going to be final touches forever. Like, people grabbing stuff.
Yeah, you're just touching you. But that's the other thing I think that like, I imagine, like, I have some natural ability, but I don't mind, like, I'm not paying attention when people are touching my face and my hair, and you know what I mean? Like, I'm in a different zone. And this was, I was going to ask you, when you're working with certain people, like, I work with Alison Brie, who's very good.
Yes.
She's very good.
She is.
And I don't have a lot of experience working with, you know.
Right. She's a very experienced
actress. And she really did something with that character. There are moments where I'm watching her in scenes, and in my mind, I'm like, oh, look at her. She's just doing it. You know, like. You know, beyond the character.
And then do you have a moment of, like, oh shit, I'm not thinking the character's thoughts?
I think that's the next frontier for me. I'm not sure I know exactly how to think the character's thoughts. I react, I listen, I know the guy, you know, there are parts, you know, there, a lot of times I think being present and acknowledging what's happening keeps me present, but it's not the character's thoughts.
Yeah, I think, well, yeah.
Doesn't everyone have their own trick?
My thing, the way I deal with, what seems to be an interfering thought,
yeah,
you know, that would be like, I'm not in the scene. There's usually a way to kind of judo it back. Like, certainly with nerves and with panic,
yeah,
you can put it, you know, into the scene. It goes to weird. Look, acting's a very, like, one of my kids said, like, no offense, but I've seen dogs be good in movies. You know, and it's true.
How's that kid doing?
I'm like, you're welcome. But nobody knows how to teach acting. That's why
because so much of it is, you know, either you can or you can't.
It's like teaching writing. Yeah. And because nobody knows how to do it, you have these cults, like, you know, sure, fundamentalist Christian sects, like, right, who look at a complicated world and go, you got to do it this way.
Right. And then, but you do, like, I think the experience, like the Gordon Lish writing cult in New York, and then there's all these acting cults out here. But, like, the one thing that gets you is it gets you interacting with other people. And, like, where did you train mostly?
I went to college, and did theater at in English at, yeah, Wesleyan, right, but and then I went to Juilliard.
Well, see, that's the thing about training to be an actor. Someplace like Juilliard, you're doing movement, you're doing dance, right? You're doing sword play. You're doing, like, you know, like,
yeah, but all that stuff doesn't matter. Like,
kind of, but yes,
you can teach, like, how to use your voice. You can
get in your body.
Yes. Yeah, but you can't, nobody knows, you know, how to teach acting. The one thing you can agree on is you got to be in the moment. You got to want something.
Can't teach anyone how to be Gene Hackman.
No.
Right?
No.
Like, you know, or it's just like when you look at huge movie actors, whoever taught them whatever, what it doesn't matter. No.
Well, it's like, you know, it's like writing. You just, like, you just got to do it a lot and have some people, right, with, exactly, some good taste telling you what to do.
Yeah, and you've done a hell of a lot. Well, let's go back. Where where were you spawned? How did it happen? Why are you? Where'd you come
from?
Why
am I me? It's funny because I'm thinking about this. Today is my mother's 103rd birthday. She passed away.
Oh, God, I was hoping that was a better
90s
story.
Yeah, it would have been better. My parents had three kids, a massive break. My brother,
yeah,
the mistake, and I'm like the mistake's friend.
Uh-huh.
So I have...
Oh, they had him, and then they're like, we got to have another one to...
A playmate.
Oh, really?
So my mom was 46 when I was born, which was weird. This year, my three oldest siblings will all have been married 50 years, which is kind of weird. Isn't that weird?
So what's the biggest amount of
19 years?
Between you and the youngest one?
And the oldest. I'm the baby.
Right. 19 years.
Yeah.
So you didn't even know them. They were out of the house?
They were. She was in college.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have a niece, you know, who's 47.
Wow.
Yeah. I've a ton of nephews and nieces, but what that meant was my parents, I was born in Madison, Wisconsin.
I like Madison, Wisconsin.
Madison, Wisconsin's fantastic.
It's a nice town.
It's a great town. It's
college is there.
Yeah. And, it's like Austin.
Yeah. And there's like smart, sweet people in the Midwest.
Yeah. And it's kind of a progressive Shangri-La. It's really wonderful.
Not as affected as Austin, I don't think. I think like there's a, like the progressiveness of the Midwest when it's there, it seems a little deeper, a little more humble.
Yes. Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Polite people.
Yeah. They're very, very sweet. Yeah. Very, very sweet. So I was born there, then I moved to Pennsylvania, and then went back to Wisconsin for high school.
Uh-huh. What was the business of the folks?
My dad was a frustrated musician. He basically worked his way up in an insurance company, but he was an amazing piano player. He had perfect pitch.
Jazz?
Yeah, kind of big band, you know, stuff. But it was interesting because he always, I think, kind of... I could tell that he kind of got off. He never thought it was a practical thing,
right,
for anybody to do. It's interesting to me because I think about this. People parenting now,
yeah,
like our generation of parenters are like, hey, we're cool. You know, we're totally cool with whatever you want to be, but what the fuck are you? Yeah. Like, are you a jock?
Yeah.
You know, are you an...
Talking about the parents or the
parents
or the kids?
The parents. There's this weird...
They're not grown up yet is what you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're overly invested in trying to control this process. I was the fifth kid.
Yeah.
My parents were like, you know, love them, keep them out of traffic.
Yeah, good luck with
them. They'll be whatever they want. So they were appropriately disinterested.
Yeah.
If my father had
but
done...
But loving?
Totally loving.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's good.
I am extremely lucky.
Yeah.
They were at a very happy place.
Right.
And they knew I was the last one.
Yeah.
Every time I walked in the room, I felt like my parents would smile. It was really loving.
That's great. Well, they've been through the worst of it. Like they,
yeah,
they,
yeah, yeah. They'd like they'd already done it, and then they'd kind of chosen to do it again. But I think about the fact that if my dad had come to me after the arsenic and old lace in seventh grade,
yeah,
and said, as I would to my kid now, oh my God, I have never seen you so happy. Do you want to take an acting class? There is no question. I would not be an actor because either I would have pulled against the leash or I wouldn't have the sense of ownership that I had because it was always this cool thing that just I was kind of in love with. Now, my dad loved it. Like I have just memory after memory of like doing a play and my dad standing up with his flash camera.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and taking a picture. But it's just it's interesting to me that
had he been overly supportive, you would have said fuck that.
Oh, if Bruce Springsteen's mom came down and said, honey, you got something, like you need to take some guitar lessons, he'd be a drunk in Newark.
Put that guitar down. Well, yeah, we've moved from Asbury Park to Newark. That's a sad story. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He had to get out of Asbury.
That's right, because his mother was there trying to get him to play guitar.
Yeah. Play it again, Bruce. No. Come on, Mom.
Well, that's interesting. I guess that's true, though, huh? So your dad was accepting, but still was like, don't put all your eggs in one basket kind of thing.
No, he was totally, like, it never occurred to me growing up in Wisconsin, like, if you're from here or you're from New York, like, yeah. You know somebody who's been in a movie, the idea of being an actor never occurred to me. It wasn't, even if it had, it would be too embarrassing a thing to say as an aspiration.
Right. What'd your siblings do? By then, they were working for Christ. They all had careers, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah. I have a brother who's a journalist. I had a sister who's a social worker and writes children's books. A sister who's a nurse. Brother who's an interpreter.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So, it's a very liberal arc there.
It is. You know. It is.
Yeah.
But when I applied to, you know, schmacting school, and I remember I said to my dad, I said, just think of it as, like, because it was 4 years.
What'd you do undergrad, though? Where'd you do undergrad?
Wesleyan.
What'd you study? English?
English and theater.
All right, so, but theater, what, you weren't in the art school. You weren't in the theater school. You were in the English department, liberal arts.
Yeah, it's basically a liberal arts school with a little crazy, you know, batshit theater department.
Right, but that was, you were just doing a minor in that.
No, I was like a real theater major. But the thing about Wesleyan that is interesting is it unintentionally created the conditions, the ideal conditions, I think, for people to like learn about acting, which is like a mini Steppenwolf. It was all self-generated stuff.
Because it was so small, or?
All the interesting stuff was outside the department, and there were just these venues where you could put a play up.
Right.
And it wasn't high pressure, and people sort of found their voices.
Right.
I was glad I got to do that, act a lot, before I got to Juilliard,
yeah.
Which is kind of a zen, sucky, you know, we're going to strip you down. It's a weird... place to be if you're too young, I think.
So you, all right, so you do the undergrad thing and you do a lot of work, you have a good time, you do a lot of plays, you know, you got some chops, you took some chances.
Yeah.
You started to feel the parameters of your talent. Right?
The limits, I call them.
You know what I mean.
Yeah.
Or what you can and can't do, maybe a little bit, or no?
Yeah, I mean, it was just fun, and it did not have any professional aspiration to it. It really didn't.
But were you getting good notices? Were you getting, like, were people thinking you were good? Was there enough to, you know, obviously, to audition for Juilliard, you must have thought, like, you know, I got this, I can do this.
Yeah, I didn't think I could do it. I thought that I could, you know, try it. I remember, like, pausing, looking at the letter when I got in.
To Juilliard?
Yeah, because it was like, you know, this kind of means you're going to try to be an actor.
Well, what did you have to do? Did you audition, what, with a modern piece and a classical piece? What was the audition?
Yeah,
do you remember?
Look here upon this picture and upon this, the counterfeit presentment of a man. It was a Hamlet thing. I don't remember what
the modern one, but it was those two. Yeah, do two pieces with four people sitting there. Kind of thing.
I hate auditions. I despise them. I don't respect them. Yeah. I don't respect their ability to, like, you know, select talent or ascertain potential.
Yeah.
I hate it. I'll tell you a really interesting thing. This happened. I really should have taken a camera. I thought of it.
Yeah.
My class from Juilliard, we all got together.
Right.
Which never happens. After 31 years, we all got together.
How many are you? Like 12, 15 people, is it? Like, what is it?
It was over 20. Yeah, it was about 20.
Yeah.
Back then, they used to put people on probation and kick them out, which was abusive and stupid.
Yeah.
You know, the actors would come there and they would be told, you know, at the first, I never was, but they'd be told, you know, you're on probation, which is a great way.
For what?
Because we might kick you out.
But for what?
Not being good or...
Oh, so that was actually sort of like, you know, you might, you're just not, because you, there was no transgression other than you might not be talented. So we're going to put a little more pressure on you.
it was horrible. There was this whole kind of school of, you know, this kind of British acting Nazi, like, school of thinking that I really for a long time disrespected in myself, that I felt like I needed a nourishing atmosphere to act in.
Yeah.
Now I'm adamant. Like, if somebody's a you know, a prick or a bully, one of the best things about the luck I've had up to this point is now I can go, shut up.
Yeah. Yeah.
You insecure son of a bitch.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of crazy at Juilliard. It was a very tough place, and there were people who were younger than me there. About half the class had gone to college, half the class hadn't.
18 years old, 19 years old.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And we all got together, and it was, I wish I'd filmed it, because it was one of the most moving. We hadn't seen each other. Only a few of us are having the careers that we remotely hoped to have.
Right.
And people instinctively sat in a circle. It was like a meeting, and everybody talked and told their stories. And it was like a chorus line, fucked our town. I mean, it was so inspiring to see what people who we were very, very close to at this time in our life had gone through. And it was heartbreaking, and to see the carnage of people walking around with an anvil of failure, you know, feeling, I think, really hurt because they didn't get, you know, the most dangerous thing in the world is to put your self-esteem on a platter and hand it to show business.
Yeah.
It won't end well.
Tell me about that, this anvil, because, like, I think about that a lot in comedy, you know, where this, there, you know, it's not a meritocracy. It doesn't matter.
No, it's not.
Yeah, there's a weird mixture of luck and persistence and representation and whatever. Yeah, there's a million things that determine whether
it is anyone, not just talent.
Yeah, has any success at all. No, talent is, you know, that's like sometimes that happens. Sometimes it, you know, because your talent might be just, you're ambitious. You might be good enough. Your talent, they being just good enough is highly rewarded.
Adequate.
Right.
Adequate.
So what about these people? I mean, I'm not looking for names, but you did feel the heartbreak in the room, is what you're saying, that there was did it end happily, this reunion?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I think people are, are to play. It was just interesting. It's interesting to me, like, you must deal with young comedians who get in touch with you, who have whose parents
sometimes.
Or friends of your parents or something. And
or they just reach out now because of the podcast. Or,
right.
Yeah.
Like, I talk to young actors all the time. I talked to one the other day, and she was coming out of Juilliard, and she's like, well, if you're good and you really, work hard and you really want it, you can have an acting career, right? And I'm like, I'm like, if you're lucky, I mean, one thing I do believe that I say to these kids is I really do believe that if you're good and you want it, and maybe you won't be an actor, but you can have a life in storytelling.
Right. Well, that's what I tell comics. I'm like, well, look, don't bank on stand-up as your only thing, because like at any given point in time, there's only a few cats that are really making a good living as stand-ups,
right,
and the rest are hammering it out. So if you can write, if you can work with other people, if you can, I think that the sketch community really changed comedy a lot. It was stand-up driven on TV, but now these people that come up through UCB or these sketch communities, they learn, just by virtue of wanting to do that, how to write, how to direct, how to work with other people, how to, listen, and
I tell actors this too. I think it's a very arbitrary, we're like, I'm an actor. Well, actually, you're a soldier in the storytelling mission.
Yeah.
I'm
hearing this a lot lately, the storytelling thing.
And a lot of people can do a lot of things they don't think that they can do. And I always tell actors, I'm like, look, man, if you can, if you have any desire to write, be writing while you're doing this.
Well, yeah, think about all the angles. I'm not naturally like that. I'm a very immediate gratification guy. Even this idea that I've talked to a few actors lately, were what you call the storytelling mission, that, we're storytellers, we're part of the story thing. I have to, intellectually kind of process that, because when I act, I'm like, am I on camera? It's like the story. Like, I like the story, but like it's...
Yeah, no, you're not on camera going, hail the storytelling mission.
But it should be in you? Is that what you mean?
No. All right. No, all I'm saying is that at the end of the day, this whole thing is about telling stories,
right,
and actors tend to not understand that they have a ground zero understanding of how to tell a story. They have like a really good sense.
Right.
Of what works and what doesn't, and whether it's directing or writing, I want them to be open to that. And just being an actor, you're it's so passive. You have to be chosen, and it's heartbreaking. I was thinking about this the other day. Like, what's humiliating about being an actor when you're struggling is you're aspiring to an arena you disrespect,
right.
Success at show is this, and you're failing. Like, it's like a double thing. It's not like you want to be a violinist, in the New York Philharmonic, and you're just not quite there.
Yeah,
like you're auditioning for a commercial, which which you despise, and you're not getting it. It's really rough.
It's horrible. Like, there's some moments where I'm like, I don't always know what that is that keeps people going, other than like, well, there's plenty of big actors that done commercials. Like, I know that level. Like, this is just a stepping stone. It's part of this process getting, but there's also like, I'm starting to realize that, that some actors, some who are lucky, or some actors who do end up getting work, they don't like doing anything.
They don't like acting?
No, they like acting, but they're just lucky because, like, if they were given some other job, they would do nothing. There are people that act that it's sort of like, are you kidding? I get to pretend and then I sit around.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, it's great.
Right. Yeah.
They're not hung up on writing or anything else. They're like, this is like, it's like a con. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I'm that's the negative side of it, but the heartbreaking
one
side.
One of the Duplass brothers said one of the greatest, not Jay, what's the brother?
Mark, is it Mark?
Yeah, Duplass? Mark.
Yeah.
Somebody asked him, is there a difference between acting, writing, and producing? And he's like, yeah, there's a big difference. And they said, what is it? And he goes, you know, if you're writing or producing or directing, it's literally like you're raising a kid. You're in a constant sense of anxiety. Am I going to be able to bring this thing to its, this child to its full potential? Yeah. When you're an actor, you're like a drunk uncle who shows up, gives the kids a bag of Oreos, and lets somebody else put them to bed. Like,
that's right. Yeah. But yeah, but that heartbreak of that, you know, yeah, the fact that you've studied, you trained, and you got to go do an audition for a commercial you want nothing to do with, but that's sort of like balancing that. You can't be idealistic. Like, you know, to get into acting for the art of it, that has to be crushed pretty quickly. You know, once you realize
yeah,
that.
Yeah, like, no, I talk to young kids who come with, a real kind of artistic, you know, snobbery and... You know, I'm like, okay, you know, okay, yeah. Sweetheart, good luck.
Yeah, right.
Good luck, Angel.
But did you do theater, right? So you come out of, what did you learn at Juilliard ultimately?
Did I learn?
Yeah. Without being cynical or funny, you must have learned something.
Here's what you learn. The great thing about Juilliard was I went into debt, you know, but I was acting 90% of the day. And that's what is the most important thing. And I'm doing very strange parts that I would not normally be cast in, which even if I didn't, not necessarily in order to be cast in those parts when you get out, but I think it's a really good exercise to play things that are outside your range.
Right. So you can see, you know, it's owning your own territory. What can I do?
Right.
Yeah.
And you were just acting all the time. Yeah. You know, like, these schools are like, you know, it's like shrinks. It's like the shrink thinks it's them.
Right.
No. What's making somebody get better is they're just coming and saying what's on their mind. You know, that's 90% of it, with the occasional insight. So it's just, it was a relentless, you know, 4 years of just acting in many... many different crazy things.
Who were? Do we know anybody that was in your class?
Tom Gibson, Wendell Pierce.
Uh-huh.
You know, those are the most, you know, sort of recognizable.
And the people that you saw at this reunion, did some of them move out of show business entirely?
Or? Some do other things. Some teach. A lot of people, you know, kind of don't do it anymore. But it's true in the other art. I knew a guy who came in second in the Tchaikovsky competition, which is a really hard thing to do. You go into these, like, this is amazing at Juilliard. You go in these, like, practice rooms, and this guy who, like, 9 hours a day since he was 8, and he just, like, takes a breath, and he throws his hands at the piano, and he's moaning and, you know, playing this, like, Beethoven. So it was, like, the most incredible thing you ever see. He comes in second in the Tchaikovsky competition. What does he do now?
I don't know.
He teaches piano to kids who don't want to learn.
Yeah.
You know, it's brutal.
Yeah. That's a very specific thing. That's a good thing about acting, is that you can
start a culty acting class.
Well, no, you can do commercials. You know, that guy, yeah. You know, the calling for a prodigy.
Right.
It's like, you know, either you're the soloist who plays with the orchestra.
Right.
Or what?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you could play.
How many new piano soloists are there every year? I don't know if,
I'm not keeping up.
Yeah. And they tend to stay around and work into old age. So it's tough. You know, it's tough in the arts. Yeah. It's tough.
But so, okay, so you do all this acting and you get out. And are you doing theater? What happens right away?
I get out and initially crickets. Nothing is happening.
What did you try to do? Were you in New York?
Yeah.
You stayed in New York.
I was in New York. I worked for a catering company.
Did you do a showcase for agents and that whole thing?
Yeah.
Nothing?
No, I got an agent, but then nothing was happening. I'd gone, you know, 4 years of graduate school.
Were you doing theater?
Well, initially I was catering in the Philip Morris dining room, seventh level of hell.
Yeah.
This corporate dining room where you had to arrange these bouquets of cigarettes. And this is like 1985, and you hear these slithery tanned people talk about the opportunities to give away cigarettes in front of girls' schools in China. That was fun. And then I worked at the World Trade Center.
Bouquets of cigarettes.
Bouquets of cigarettes. And then...
Did you smoke?
Did I?
Yeah.
I would bum cigarettes.
Oh, you never smoke.
But I wouldn't buy.
You don't got the personality? You don't got the addictive thing?
No, I have to be careful with them. Like, yeah. I'll bum them.
Yeah.
I realized that early on, I then got a part in a play, and... after acting would be a time where somebody else would have a cigarette and I'd bum a cigarette.
Sure, yeah.
World Trade Center. And I thought, well, I only have cigarettes when I work. And then I realized I work all the time.
Yeah, I'm always bumming cigarettes. Where did you work at the World Trade Center?
Yeah. At the Port Authority dining room. This was in, 85. And then I got... Bill Pullman dropped out of a show, Curse of the Starving Class, that was moving from off Broadway to off Broadway, and he got a part in a movie which was a big deal, and he had to take it, and they were opening in a week, and they thought about closing it down, but I ended up getting it. So my first gig was this Curse of the Starving Class. Which was this Sam Shepard play with Kathy Bates, which was like dream gig. I mean, it was scary. You had to urinate on stage. You had to, this kid freaks out. I usually don't like nudity in plays because you just sit there and go, oh, wow. I hope that actor's cousin isn't here.
That guy's naked.
That's happening.
Yeah.
But it was a weird thing because this guy comes out completely naked and ends up slaughtering a lamb who we called Meryl Sheep. And I had to go into it in a week, and it's a big part with a big monologue, and I got to meet Sam Shepard, and that was intense.
You're what, 22, 23?
No, I'm 24.
Yeah. And he was directing, or he was just around?
No, he just came by with Jessica Lange.
Yeah. Oh, you're fancy pants now.
Yeah, it was.
Did you know Pullman?
No. I ran into him in like the Mayfair a couple of years ago, and I was like, thanks for the career. Because it really was like the first.
Did he remember? Did he know?
Yeah. He was very, very sweet about it. But it was weird. I had this great, for like 9 months, I was doing this play, and it was weird. You know, Kathy Bates was amazing.
She's great.
She's great. I the first night, I had to go on. I had to learn this play in like 6 days.
Yeah.
And there's a big monologue at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I remember the first couple of days of rehearsal where you're looking into these wonderful actors' eyes and you can see that they don't think you're going to be able to get there, which is a horrible thing. And I survived.
Kind of sympathetic.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Oh, honey. Sweetie, are you giving it a go? Anyway, I was backstage right before it was opening night, and there were critics, and I'd gotten the thing like, a week before. Ugh. And I'm backstage, and it's emotional at the beginning, and I'm sitting on the floor, and my legs are crossed, and I'm like, getting emotional, and Kathy Bates walks by and goes, what are you doing? Preparing?
Nice.
But there's a guy named Eddie Jones. I really wouldn't be an actor if this guy who played my dad, Eddie Jones, who was this terrific actor, got me through that.
Yeah,
I could have, it was scary. I was walking around.
Yeah, I can't
naked
imagine it. And you just did it.
Here's when you don't want to be naked.
Yeah.
In rehearsal. Like, yeah. If the play is going on, that's great. Like, you're in the reality of the play, whatever that is, and you're naked. What you don't want to hear is the director go, okay, hang on one second. Because then you're just a schmuck with your dick hanging out.
Standing there with other people.
Yeah, it's like, can we not break the reality?
And it's not right. And it's not like movies or TV where you got a dick sock on. No, you just got to wait it out.
Those are weird.
Hey, they are weird.
Yeah, I'm wearing one right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You took a liking to it? You figure you wear it?
Oh, my God.
So how did Eddie Jones help you?
He just said to me, he is an incredibly kind guy who had faith in me when he shouldn't have.
Uh-huh. And you had a lot of scenes with him?
Yeah. He was my dad. It's that complicated
shepherd dad thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shepherd daddy.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, that's nice. It's nice to have that, the one person with faith or trust, or you at least can relax, you know, or know that, like, you have some support.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I'm like trying to manage that confidence without it curdling
breaking apart into
arrogance.
Well, arrogance, but the other way, like, you know, like what it takes to sort of
a full shame spot.
Yeah, like, you know, like that's the one thing that experience gets you is less of those.
But I have to say, one thing that's interesting to me is that you can always judo your performance insecurity into whatever's going on in the scene. And actually, there is nothing worse than a fully confident actor.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree with that. I mean, it makes sense to me. But like, what I'm surprised at is that I don't know how deep the shame spirals go with you. But like that, as you get older, you can choose to not honor that voice. Like, to not, like, I can't do this. I can't, and just, like, drag everyone around you down.
Right.
You know, I you know, like, it took a long time for me to just sort of, like, no, just keep it to yourself.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, I have this whole thing, like, with, I am not somebody who I don't think is a prick on a set.
Yeah.
And I have the other problem is, you know, I want to be loved and
running around making funnies and
yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
But if I'm honest, anytime any director has ever said anything to me, I go through three silent beats.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
Yeah.
I suck. Okay, what? And I really believe that that is a universal response, and some people get stuck on I suck. Some, you know, people
right.
who live there. Some people live on fuck you.
Yeah, yeah.
Most people pretty quick get to the, you know.
But you hear, you the cycle starts right when it's probably just like, Bradley?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just the tone of your name being called.
You know, Brad. Matt Perry and I used to, these directors would do these, like, devastating notes, like right before you roll, like they go, guys, can we be quiet? Are we rolling? Okay, we're rolling. And Brad, don't push for that joke. Action. So, you know, like some devastating, are we rolling? Yeah. Brad, just pick the prop up. You know, don't make a meal. Action. You know, you're totally humiliated. So when Matt.
You're trying too hard, Brad.
I got to direct Matt. Yeah, don't try too hard. You know, just say the line. Action. Don't do that shit with your face. Action. So when. When I got to direct, fuck with Matt, on Studio 60.
Oh, yeah.
I would go, are we rolling? Okay, rolling. Okay. And Matt, you peaked 10 years ago. Action. You know, there is no happiness. The reward is death. Action. Like these devastating notes that you have to, like, you know, go right into.
What do you think happened with that show?
What do I. you know, here's what I think about that show.
Studio 60.
Studio 60. Aaron needs kind of moral elevation.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that first. So, like, where did your relationship with him start?
It's funny because people ask me, like, how did you meet Aaron Sorkin? I did a movie that I was snobby about doing called Revenge of the Nerds 2, Nerds in Paradise.
Yeah, was that one of those acting decisions you made where you thought, I can really take my craft to...
I'm going to dig deep. I want to explore this. I mean, I've played an asshole, but I've never played one on vacation.
Yeah.
And I met a guy, Tim Busfield, who... And he and I would hang out. We went to the Humana Festival in Louisville and saw a bunch of plays. And then he went into... He replaced in A Few Good Men. And then he said to Aaron, I think you... This guy... I think you should see this guy. So I auditioned for Aaron, and Aaron made me like the Kevin Bacon part.
Yeah.
And then I got to understudy the lead, and then I got a really big shot because usually they put, no offense to me, a fading television star in one of these things to keep a play going, but he ended up giving it. Aaron stepped in and said, no, I want him to be the lead. So I got to be the lead in a Broadway play, which was stunning, and I didn't deserve it. And that's where I met him.
And because, like, with him, I don't know him at all, you know, but I find that as time goes on, that it's Sorkinese is its own sort of, it's its own type of writing, its own type of acting in a way. Like, I started to notice it, not like West Wing, but more a little there, but also in the movies, that in order to play Sorkin, you have to know how to do it.
It is. Listen, I've seen really good actors who just like get the Zen sucked out of them, you know,
right,
having to do it. And there is this technical verbal obligation that you have to get to your unconscious place so that your blood can flow. Like, the key to it, it's the same thing with Mamet, who pisses me off because he teaches acting.
Why does that piss you off?
Because he's a playwright.
And what do you think about the way he teaches acting?
I think it's playwright centric. It's Which like, just like, say my words very clearly.
You're a pawn in my game.
Yes, yes.
Anyone can do what you do.
Anyone can do it. Just talk, say my words. But the great Mamet actors, their blood is flowing while they're fulfilling, you know, this album.
They're great actors despite him. They didn't learn how to act through Mamet.
No.
Right.
No.
Yeah, sure. You can bring life to the rhythm, man. Yeah, it's like Shakespearean in a way.
Yeah, yeah. And some people just get fritzed thinking about the logistics of the language.
I imagine part of an actor's struggle with Sorkin would be like, would a person say this? Doesn't matter. If you put the emotion into it, they will seem as though they would say it.
Yeah, he's a very interesting writer. It's really fun to do.
When
it's like flowing, it feels like, you know, volleyball or something.
No, I love it. Like, and I didn't notice it until the Steve Jobs movie. Mm-hmm. Because, like, I watched that movie, and whatever anyone else was saying about whether it was real, whether it wasn't real, I'm like, well, it doesn't matter if it's real. This is like, you know, Hepburn and Tracy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, in order to do this language thing that he does, you've got to get it. And when it's working, it's spectacular. I mean, yes. I don't give a fuck about whether, you know, the story is what, you know, the device of the story.
Well, listen, it's extraordinary. That guy wrote the equivalent of 11 feature films a year.
With West Wing.
For 4 years. It will never be done again. It's an extraordinary achievement. Nobody will ever do that.
Yeah,
nobody's ever going to do it. And he was writing, you know, we would go in. I remember these, like, you go in and it was like, you know, you got a new Arthur Miller play every week.
Was and everybody our, like, was were you and Allison and everyone else was just sort of like, oh my God, every script that came out?
They were pretty, you know, they were pretty great, and they were a lot of, they were a lot of fun. I mean, Aaron is an impatient, in the best way, an impatient showman. He's desperately worried he's going to lose the audience's attention. So he brings these wonderful characters and, you know, there's a lot of wit. You were talking about Studio 60. One of the things with Studio 60 is, like, on West Wing, you have the political world. Like, basically, you got C-SPAN, and you bring in wit.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, thank you.
Funny.
When you're doing
people.
SNL,
yeah,
and you bring in wit, you're pissed off.
Yeah.
You know, I always felt that show, I remember talking with Aaron about it, that I felt, you know, like, I want to see, I think Aaron could write a great, well, I guess he did.
Yeah.
Afterwards, but like an Anderson, I think like Anderson Cooper is under interesting pressures, you know, where he does his, you know, talks about a school shooting,
does a presidential
campaign, and then does, you know, has to get ratings.
Right.
The SNL, like the urgency in that show, that show was basically a show about writer's block. And
Studio 60.
Yeah, and tried to build this terror of, you know, all the pressure that was on Matt's character. Well, I know Saturday Night Live is going to be on this week, and I know they'll get something done.
Right.
And it may not be good, all of it, but I think it had a sort of, I don't know, false confidence.
Yeah, it wasn't authentic.
Right.
The show, the premise.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably right. Oh, and then he did what? He did Newsroom? Was that what it was called? With Jeff Daniels? Was that him?
Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, he's a brilliant, brilliant writer.
Are you guys friends?
Yeah. I mean, I see him. He's a big part of my life. I see him every couple of months. We have dinner.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's weird. And Aaron had this power. My joke with him is that, you know, a great show about democracy, and he ran it like Kim Jong-il.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, we were waiting for the story, you know, to come from him, and that's the way it needed, you know, it needed to be. But it sort of, and we treated him like a playwright.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to make all these words work.
Right.
You know, we're not going to go to, you know, hey, Bill, don't we get it with to be or not to be? Like,
right.
You know, yeah. do we need, that's the question? You know, you would make it work.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, he's one of these, like, I don't know anything about him. And I definitely tend to mythologize people in my mind. And then when I meet them, I'm like always surprised that they're human. But he seems to be sort of capable of these, you know, inhuman feats, you know, of creation that are sort of amazing.
Well, he does an interesting thing. He's like, I'm going to paint on a big canvas.
Yeah.
Like with West Wing. It's so funny to me. There's all these political shows now, like all kinds of political shows. You know, the Veep is the comedy.
Yeah.
And Scandal is the kind of pulpy thing.
And the other one, the one that, the House of Cards.
Yeah. And when we were doing the show, it was like, that arena can't work.
Right. Yeah. Now it's like completely, you broke it open for everybody. Let's talk, like, you did a lot, you've done a lot of movies, a lot of television, and you were great and Transparent. That must have been, in terms of that set, somebody who's been around as long as you have, that must have been a fairly unique environment.
Incredibly unique.
Like, how did you come to that?
How did I come to
it? Did Jill ask you to do it? What was the casting?
I had, it was funny because I was here and it wasn't a point of pride, but I had noted the fact that I was like the only actor of my generation who started in New York who had never done a Law and Order.
Really?
So I was like, well, I'm
well,
never.
You missed it. You kind of missed it, right?
I just
weren't in those lean times during that time. You were a little before, right?
I was up for stuff. It just never happened. And then I got asked to do this SVU, but it meant going to New York. And I'm like, I don't want to go to New York. And they said, it's with Tambor. And he's always been one of my favorite actors. And I was like, oh, if it's with him, yeah, I'll go. And so I did that. In the middle of a scene, he said, it's weird, this, like, doing this streaming show at Amazon. I'm like, Amazon's doing stuff?
Yeah.
This was, you know, before it started.
Right.
He said, yeah, and it got picked up. And then there was this part of this cross-dressing, and he suggested me to chill.
Okay. And, you know, but that it just sounds to me like I know Jill a bit and some people that are involved in the show, but it sounds to me that this was a very sort of modern work environment. That,
yes. Yeah,
that was highly not politicized, but it was at the cutting edge of the new respect and ways of engaging with people on gender levels.
Yes. And it was, you know, it was a freaky set. I mean, you know, there's this kind of dilation on that set because people are, you know, you're dealing, you know, I never wore a dress before and, sure. You know, I really want to make this work and it's, you know, it brings up complicated feelings.
Did it?
Yeah. Yeah. It like was what? Cool.
Like what? Like, in, you know.
My number one fear was that I would be condescending about it. I had one of the most amazing experiences doing research for this. I'm gonna Sean Penn this a little. I got in touch with a group that cross dresses and signed up to go. You know, I was just gonna go.
Yeah.
You know.
Sure. Hang out, observe.
Yeah. But I was, you know, I was gonna go undercover. You know, cross dressing. And it was delicate to get invited to this thing, understandably, and I got myself invited.
As a spy.
Right. And then I realized...
And also, you're a public personality, so...
Well, yeah, I'm vaguely familiar.
Yeah. I don't know about that.
Then I called him up, and I said, look, I want to be honest with you. This is a safe place for you. Is there any... I'm doing this thing. It was before the show had come out, and I said, I can assure you, this is not going to sentimentalize or condescend. And I just want to do whatever I can to get it right. They talked to everybody in the group, and I went. I was terrified walking into this place. I mean, terrified. So I was now not cross-dressing.
Well, it's sort of like there's part of your masculinity at stake because you don't know yourself in this way.
Yeah. Yeah, I was shaking. Like, I've done weird research.
What were you afraid of, though? Could you put your finger on it? Like, yeah, walking into the place? I mean...
It was an... inarticulate reptilian brainstem Freudian fear. Uh-huh. I don't know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I don't know. Was I going to be turned on?
Oh, yeah. Right. So, yeah, you were threatened.
Yeah.
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 So what happened?
Door opens and, you know, it's somebody who really doesn't pass. Kind of gruffly,
yeah.
You know. Goes, hey, you know, yeah. Come on in. Mini skirt,
sure.
I'm like, you know, you can see me kind of go, like take a deep breath, going, this is going to be intense. It turned out to be one of the most moving things, honestly, that I've ever seen. They get together. This is it's an apartment where people meet.
Yeah.
This is the night. They get dressed.
Yeah.
The people who want to go out, some people really want to get dressed and go out and, uh-huh. you know, kind of pass.
Uh-huh.
They get falafel. They bring it back. And they sit together and they eat falafel. And nobody's getting drunk. Nobody's trying to pick up people.
Yeah.
And the range of... experience was astonishing. You know, there were a lot of people going heroically through 12-step stuff. You know, they have a secret or you know, they'd gotten beaten up. You know, their kids wouldn't talk to them.
Uh-huh.
You'd hear these like heartbreaking stories, and then this like 75-year-old goes, you know, I'm hearing all these stories of woe. It's, you know, it's like, my life has been a party. This has been amazing. You know, I'm taken care of. This watch is gold, you know. And then, you know, there was an army guy there. There were some people who are extraordinarily feminine and almost porny. Some have like a shmata on, you know, with a wig. But it was just interesting to sit with these people who needed a sanctuary to be themselves.
Right.
It was really fascinating. There was this wonderful, God, what a character, like a 17-year-old Puerto Rican girl who did all their hair, who loved to come on Wednesdays and do these guys up. Anyway, what that experience did was it gave me total freedom. Like there's a million different ways,
to do it honestly.
To do it honestly. But I was always afraid, am I going to, you know, make a cheap joke?
Right. Well, yeah. But you mean on set? You mean, or just like, right, like you, not during a scene, you were going, but like you were worried about your own weird defensive disposition popping up in the middle of it, that would not be a good set to do that on.
I do remember right before they said action, Jeffrey and I are fully cross-dressed.
Yeah.
And they're about to say action. And I looked at him and I said, you realize this is the memoriam reel.
Did he laugh?
Yeah.
Because he seems to be pretty deep in it when he does it.
Very deep in it. And
I guess he's not doing it anymore. He got into some trouble.
Yeah. I think he always felt, am I doing justice to this?
Yeah, he did some insane work on that.
Yes,
thing.
Incredible work.
It's like some real risky shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a crazy set.
Yeah, but it must have been a real baptism in, you know, the edge of cultural progress there. You know, what's going on in terms of identification, identity, how to address people, how to be respectful, especially when you're coming to it at your age or my age, where things are changing that dramatically
right.
in those communities. Like the fear of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing must be extraordinary.
I find, I have a nephew who is trans, and I actually find that most trans people are not freaked out
right.
about pronouns, because that's not the issue. Of course, it's an understandable stumble that
sure.
people are going to make.
And right.
we're all trying to be comfortable. So if, you know, we're not going to, you know, call you a hater because you misspoke.
Right. I think that these things, on those levels where that dialogue is happening around pronouns, that sort of has to happen to maintain the territory that they've gotten. You know what I mean? That there needs to be a respect there. I mean, maybe it'll make people more nervous about what to call people, but it needs to be, there needs to be posts up saying like, we're real. This is happening.
Yeah. And words are, words are important. Yeah,
right. How did you, let's talk about the movie that's out now and up for Academy Awards. How did he find you? How did that happen?
I heard that they were interested in me for a movie, and I was the biggest Key and Peele fan in the world. I think he is a profound performer.
Like, Jordan?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Like the depth of the stuff he was doing in those sketches. And if there is a tragedy about Get Out, it is that he doesn't want to act anymore.
Yeah.
But I had been asking for years, just give me honestly, anything in a background sketch. Really? In one of his sketches.
Yeah, yeah,
just,
yeah.
I just want to be in one, and my son loves it.
Yeah.
So I would have done anything he was going to do. When I first heard about it, I assumed he was going to be acting in it. Then I talked to him, and I remember he said, do you like horror movies? And I'm like,
yeah.
Do I, I don't run out to see.
Right. I get them, but I don't go see them.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's like, I really love them, and the reason I love them is they're about stuff you can't talk about. They're about death and sex, and nobody's done race. And weirdly, you know, like I was trying to think of just movies I've seen, you know, with a sympathetic black lead in a horror movie. It's like Night of the Living Dead, you
right?
Know, 1968.
Yeah. Didn't turn out well for that guy.
No. No,
he did what he could.
He did what he could.
Yeah.
So then he sent me the script, and I remember coming out and saying to my fiance, like, this, I've never read anything like this, and I don't know if it's going to work, but it'll be amazing.
Yeah. So on paper, it looked pretty great.
Yeah, it was like, whoa, it was this combination of like what I call like a forehead knocker of like, oh yeah, like why didn't 10 years ago, haven't we done a horror movie that is really about race?
Yeah.
You know, and it was a combination of that, and it was not something I had ever seen before. And you're reading it and you're going, is this funny? Like, I didn't know where I was.
Uh-huh. That's good.
Yeah, I didn't know where I was genre-wise. You know, do you know it's going to work? No. Like, do you finish scenes going, yeah, no? Like, it's like, I don't know. Like, you know, is this...
Yeah, because also there's this menacing wrong to it. Like, I imagine, yeah, you finish scenes and you're like, that's kind of... horrible.
Yeah, and like, are you tipping it?
Or,
you know, are you setting it up without tipping it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, you know, and Jordan was, he said, you know, this, it's just like comedy horror. He's like, you got to set it up without anticipating it. Let the tension, you know, expand and then pull a trigger. And either it's a laugh or, you know, or it's a scream.
Right.
He was very careful not to, he didn't want any jokes in there. There were no jokes. All the laughs, like, are, I mean, I remember at one point, at the end, I'd get killed with a deer head.
Yeah.
And it was just like one take where they ram this deer head into me, and I have a white beard, and blood, you know, comes out of my mouth.
Yeah.
And so they want to get it one take. And my one disagreement with him was... I said, can I just like get hit and go, oh dear. And he said, no, it's a joke. Because it's deer. He's like, no.
Right.
No.
Oh, really?
No.
oh, it was a pun.
Yeah, it was a little pun.
Yeah, yeah. You can't have no room for puns anywhere.
But it was a 22-day shoot. Nobody thought it was going to work.
There is a bit of a comedic relief with that. The guy's friend, that comic from Chicago. What's it?
Lil Rel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, that guy, it wasn't joke, but it was sort of like that was reality calling.
Yeah.
And that was very funny.
Yes. Yes.
Great ending.
Great ending. You know, he changed it, right?
No, I don't know anything about it.
The original ending was you see him killing everybody in the driveway, and you hear a cop car, and you see the red lights on his face. Cut. He's in prison. Lil Rel, the TSA guy, is visiting him and saying, "We got to get you out. We know the truth. You're not gonna, you know, rot in a prison." And Chris, Daniel Kaluuya's character, says, "No, it's okay. We stopped him." That was the end. The brilliant thing that Jordan did was, which could be perceived as kind of a lecture about mass incarceration or injustice or something.
Sure.
What he did with the ending, the way he reshot it, was you see the lights in the guy's face. There is a huge laugh when the door opens and you realize it's not a cop, it's a TSA car. There's a huge laugh of relief. And it's a much more powerful way, because if you are laughing at that, you have internalized the truth that the cops can be a threat to an innocent black man.
Oh, when you see those lights,
yeah.
you know, you're the whole history of that hits you.
But it's so much better than just sort of telling you this, right. You know, an injustice occurred. What he did is the most unbelievable thing I've ever experienced. First time out of the gate, 22 days. Like, it was quick.
Yeah, and he's a solid guy.
He's the sweetest.
Yeah.
You know, and there's just glee in him.
Yeah.
And he is kind to everybody, which I really appreciate.
Oh, that's sweet. Did I hear you say fiance?
Yeah.
So you're getting married again?
Yeah.
When's that happening?
I think it's going to happen during my... It seems like when your three oldest siblings are celebrating 50 years and the whole family's going to be together, that might be a good time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Amy Landecker.
From Transparent.
From Transparent.
You met her on Transparent.
Yeah.
In a dress. You were wearing a dress when you met her.
I was wearing a dress. We did not connect at that time.
Uh-huh. Has she been married?
Yes.
Kids?
Yes.
So you've both had lives?
Yes. We've both come out of some emotional white water into a glade, a cool pool of peace.
Oh, good. Well, I hope that works out for you. I'm serious.
Yeah, thank you.
It was great talking to you, man. Thanks
you
for
too.
Coming.
My pleasure.
Nice guy, right? He's got a little cut to him, got a little edge, got a little intensity, grounded. I like him. I like that Bradley Whitford fella. As I said, you can see the new season of The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu. He's in that. That premieres this week. You can you see him in the movies Get Out and The Post. You can watch reruns of The West Wing. For probably a year if you really wanted to. I'll talk to you again from probably Dublin, I'm thinking. Maybe Amsterdam. I'll let you know at the time of recording. Boomer lives!